Welcome to the Fly Culture Podcast, bringing you interviews, reviews, and fishing tips. Here's your host, Pete Tygus.
Welcome back, everyone, to the Fly Culture Podcast. I hope you're doing well. It's been kind of cool to be able to get back out on the river. Our home water is really, really close, so it's just a short journey. And it's been a real shot in the arm to make a few casts for some salmon. Thoroughly, thoroughly enjoyed that aspect of it. I'd like to start the podcast by saying a huge thank you to Griff Jones. I know he's a listener of the podcast, and he'd been listening about me falling out of love or tying flies and sent me some. So I'd like to say a huge thank you for that. These podcasts are great fun to put together and to record. And I always make sure I research my guests thoroughly before interviewing them. In the case of today's one, though, he's literally travelled the world with a fly rod and gone from Hertfordshire to Australia via Scotland, from Wales to the Bahamas via Dorset. I don't think there's many places he hasn't actually visited. He's also a guide and former chairman of the Game Angling Instructors Association. It's my real pleasure to welcome Tony King as a guest to the Fly Culture Podcast today. Tony, it's great to have you along. How are you doing?
Very well, thanks, Pete. Pleasure to be here, mate.
And how are you hanging in there okay?
Yeah, I mean, it's tough for everybody, isn't it? Especially, I mean, I think I've been indoors more in the last year than I have in my whole life so far. We're bearing up. It'll be over good soon, hopefully.
Yeah, it feels like there's some end in the sight now, isn't there? And we can get back to doing what we love doing. And like I said in the introduction there, for me, you know, my home river's near, so it's just a short few minutes in the car to get there. And it has been really cool to be able to just get back out doing what I love so much. And I guess you're really looking forward to that, aren't you?
Absolutely, yeah. I mean, It's different every year, as you well know. I mean, every, you know, you have to have a very loose plan with fishing, don't you? Pretty much with life as well, in my case. But it's going to be hard because a lot of people this year are going to have missed their fishing for quite a long time. So I think possibly the settling people down is going to take a bit longer than maybe it has done in previous seasons, but we'll see, you know.
Yeah. I know when lockdown on the first one or whatever one it was now, and I literally ran to the river with my rod and was convinced I was going to fish like a maniac and managed to sit down, and I'd give myself a good talking to and say, look, calm down, boy, wait for one to rise and then go from there. And those moments are really, really special, aren't they? And I think they're the things that make us miss it so much as well, aren't they? And it'll be good for everyone when they're able to get out and hit the places they love to hit again.
Yeah. Well, I mean, it's, as you say, I mean, during lockdown, I've made about 3 fishing rods that I've never used, probably never will. I've repaired old cane rods that kind of needed a bit of love and attention, and done all sorts of things. Even tried to tie a few flies, Pete, which when you've got a pound of pork sausages on each hand, it's not that easy, as you know. And the other thing is the age thing. Christ, you know. I have I'll bring it into shot. I have this thing, which is like a magnifying electrician's thing, really. And then I have to wear a pair of magnifiers as well. If I drop anything, it's lost forever. You know, no more tying a fly, dropping a bit of stuff and picking it up. It's like a major bloody search for everything that comes along. But there you go.
The joys of getting older, and it does mean that those seasons seem to go a little bit quicker as well, I've noticed recently.
All depends who you're out with, mate.
Good answer. Good answer. So have you managed to get out and do some casting? Have you got anywhere nearby that you can go play with the rod and do a bit of casting and stuff?
Well, we've got a park up the road, which is it's where Sandsfoot Castle is, which was the there were two castles built by Henry VIII to guard the fleet when all the boats and things were in here. And it's just down the road. And it, you know, for years I've been able to go down there and there's like an earthwork, like a bank, and I can cast along the top of the bank. And but they there's a little cafe in the park, and it's been open during lockdown for takeaways. And it's the most crowded. It's like going to Piccadilly down my park at the moment. And I've got the beach just over the road as well, and I get down there occasionally. But, well, fingers crossed, a group of us meet at a sort of Holby Lakes over near Romsey. Gaia people, a few Apgai people come along. You know, it's a kind of open house thing. And hopefully we're going to have one of those the first weekend after lockdown. So I'll get to see everybody and find out just how rusty I've become.
Yeah. I must admit, when this weather, and you'd say we were talking off mic about the wet weather and everything else and the effect on rivers, and I'd felt the same and was pleasantly surprised when I picked up a rod and thought, God, this is going to be terrible. And it was a surprise. But the interesting thing for me is that I ripped independent both of my rotator cuffs, and I knew I'd be picking up a two-handed rod. And that was really good fun to figure out how to get the most out of what movement I have. And a lot of the movements come back to a degree. But it was fun trying to figure out how to not put too much stress on. And I had some really interesting times sort of thinking about, right, okay, how do I work this? How am I going to do that? And that really sort of got the cogs going. And then when you get out on the river, it was really interesting to see it actually worked. And I didn't have to take 9 Nurofen afterwards as well, which was great news. But it reminded me, funnily enough, as well, of the first time I met you. And I was really touched that it was at the – I know, obviously – the circle we know in the instructing and guiding world, we all sort of know each other. We may not know each other well, but we took a stand at the first London Fly Fair, and you made a point of coming over and saying hello. And I thought that was a really cool thing to do, and I was really touched by that.
Well, I was interested in what you do, Pete.
You're the first person.
That's God, there's a story. That hall, that agricultural, God, where is
Islington?
Islington, yeah. I did years and years ago in another world. I did a fashion show there with the company I used to co-run with my ex-wife, and in the middle of the show, I got a spot on the forehead, and it turned out to be chickenpox. And I nearly devastated the fashion industry. I hope I didn't do the same to the fishing one.
I assume at this fashion show you weren't modelling.
No, no, far from it. I look at me. What a question.
But that was really, really cool to be able to do that. And I know I spoke with somebody else about the shows and things like that. And that one had huge potential. And I'm really looking forward to the BFFI, if that takes place next year, where you get to see people. And that, I guess, that moment when you came and said hello sums it all up, really, doesn't it? That you get to see people you either know or know about and get the time to spend time with them as well, don't you?
Absolutely. Well, we had Dave in common at that time, didn't we? He was a joint client who was you're quite into motorbikes as well, aren't you?
Quietly.
Because he was always turned up on a massive, great big motorbike of some description. Yeah. Yeah, well, I mean, the shows are, you know, as you say, I hope the IFI, whatever, goes really well. But the shows have got a little bit disappointing over the years, don't you think?
Yeah, I think they probably just run out of steam a little bit. And the industry, I guess it may have been with the social media, internet, everything else, that it's easier to reach people in a different way. You know, as you're, I'm sure you'll agree, there's nothing better than picking up a fly rod and casting it and deciding for yourself whether you like it or not. And that's where those sorts of situations come into their own and work really well. And I noticed a lot of that was going on at the London, does obviously happen at the BFFI and everything else. And yeah, I wonder if we might start seeing, I guess it's a hope really, that we might see a little bit of a renaissance where, you know, these become a hub for people to get together again and see each other. And it'll be exciting to see the first one, whatever the first one is, when everyone, you know, what attendance is like, if the growth numbers are to be believed as well in fishing, if we do see a big swell of people coming back to these things again. It'll be interesting, won't it?
Well, absolutely. I mean, well, we're from a certain time in our lives, we sounds like we were in a similar kind of area, and everybody used to go fishing then. I mean, it was probably half a dozen of the lads in my class were regular fishermen when I was at school, all the way through. More, probably. The line of guys in welly boots and white socks and old D-mob jackets down on the Lee in those days was a sight to behold, as I'm sure it was for you too. It's yeah, I mean, it is strange how it's kind of dropped off from being, well, number one non-spectator sport for years and years and years, wouldn't it, in this country? I mean, I'm lucky in Weymouth because, you know, the sea's just there and you do see a lot of people going sea fishing still. But it doesn't seem to be that many people. Well, I'm surprised at how often the people I see on the river I know already. Let's put it that way. I don't meet so many strangers anymore.
Yeah. Yeah. I hope those things sort of do pick up, and if it is to be believed. And we're going to go through your fishing timeline because it is absolutely extraordinary. And for the listeners, you know, it's worth listening to this. I don't think there's many places Tony's not been to and not experienced. But what we've seen in recent, it feels over this winter after lockdown, I guess the hotter summers, that we've seen a growth in the more left field species. And you know, the pike, you know, when I first started in the early 2000s, sort of fly fishing for pike, but, you know, it's gone on before then. And I looked at the mullet side of things as well. And reading your, you know, looking at your timeline, I think you were catching mullet on the fly in the 70s, weren't you?
Absolutely, yeah. I mean, not that many. You know what mullet are like on the fly. If you want to go mad, you know, that's a good target species for your I probably first went fly fishing for mullet at Dalston down near Swanage, and that was probably in the 60s actually, Pete, with an old an old CC de France I found in the loft of a house I was doing some work on.
That's a nice find.
Well, it was. I mean, it was very handy for me. It bought my first carbon fibre fly rod ever when I eventually sold it. Yeah, we used to fish for mullet down at Dalston. You go down there with like a a spinning rod and what we used to do, pull the wick out of a candle and thread the line through it, use it as a casting weight. And then you remember those little polystyrene craft beads that you got in craft shops and things like that. About three of them painted black, threaded on the leader, and then a single hook and a couple of maggots. And then we'd go down with a fork and chuck the weed in the water. And at that time, the down at Swanage, the sewage farm was around there, Pemberley Point, and there were vast shoals of mullet that just followed the shit slick, I suppose, really, yeah. If you think about it. And when you started throwing the weed in it, it'd discolour the water, and then you'd see the little fins coming up in it. And all you do is cast out everything, put it into a straight line, so you had a straight line of your little black beads. And then any time they change, you just hit it. And then after a while, we thought, I reckon we could do this with a fly rod. The trouble was, it was a steep shelving shingle bank. And, you know, we're talking about me as a young teenager then, you know, with my cousin Kenny. And it was probably more Kenny's idea than mine. But you know how difficult it is with mullet. When one does take it, to have cracked the bend of the hook off on a stone behind you when you were casting badly, it's just too much. So I didn't do it that often, but I did do it. And then later, after I'd started a family, really, I was living in Anglesey. I was working for Bangor University in the forestry department. And started fly fishing for mullet along the Menai Straits. Because, as I said to you before, Pete, I've always been lucky. When I came back from Australia, I landed a job as a kind of forestry technician, looking after an arboretum on the Menai Strait that was between the Clifton Suspension Bridge and the Thomas Telford Railway Bridge. So all that Doctor's Island, all that bass fishing, mullet fishing paradise was where I actually worked. Well, when I worked.
And so you'd been sort of fishing from a very, very young age on the Lea around Hartford, the Rib, which I know a little bit because of Rib Valley and the river that went along there. But your serious sort of fly fishing started when you went to Winchester College of Art. And I guess the itching runs down that neck of the woods as well. And you sort of, that's where your fly fishing really started to get serious for you. Would that be right?
Absolutely, yeah. I mean, it was kind of frowned upon to bait fish in Hampshire, really. And the way I used to, I mean, on the Rib, if we can backtrack slightly, I mean, on the Rib, I belong to the Abbey Cross Angling Association. My Uncle Ronnie was their treasurer back in those days, funnily enough. And the Rib was a beautiful little chalk stream that they had that was like a cycle ride after school from where I lived, you know. And it all started off freelining for chub and things like that, you know, really. And my early fly fishing was like artificial bait fishing, really. I mean, I couldn't cast worth a shit, but I could get what I was using where I wanted it to be. And I think all my fishing has kind of revolved, really, about that fascination, about that divide, you know, we're above the water, they're below the water, and trying to work out how to get it, how to get what you want in front of it. You know, it's just, and it does, it takes you over. I mean, if I'd have made it as a painter, I dare say I'd still be probably doing what I do today anyway. You know, it's, I mean, the fishing's probably been one of the main constants, really, in all the way through. I mean, I was very lucky, sort of, doesn't sound like the right thing to say now, but I think it was a gender-specific activity throughout my family, fishing. I mean, I had my relatives down here in Dorset, mainly sea fishing, My uncle George and my cousin Kenny had a boat, and back in the 50s and 60s, if you lived in a coastal town in Dorset, you had a summer job and a winter job. And their summer job was crabbing, lobstering, and selling the process, well, putting out, obviously catching loads of mackerel, but and putting out trots and things, and selling the produce to the hotels that then, during the winter, Kenny was a cabinet maker, upholsterer. They'd spend the winter, and it was all boarding houses then. There were none of these holiday apartments or anything like that. Everybody came down and stayed at a boarding house. In the winter, he'd redo the carpets, fix the chairs that had broken and things like that. And in the summer, provide the seafood. So I had a very lucky start there, if you see what I mean. And then up in, my old man was a bit of a rocket scientist, really. He was a design engineer for guidance systems for sea-to-air ballistic missiles, obviously ex-Navy. And we moved up to Hertfordshire with his work, really, because he worked for, well, it was English Electric at that time, but became British Aerospace. And again, you know, there I lucked in because he used to design these things to make missiles go where you wanted them to, and then go down to Aberporth in Wales or up to Scotland to fire them off into the sea. So I got to fish the Tavy and things like that down in Wales and all sorts of things. You know, I mean, I was very, very lucky. I mean, my dad wasn't a fly fisherman at all, but he was a very, very thinking angler. You know, he used to do all sorts of things. He even started making his own cane rods at one time. So I had the right background to end up being a hairy layabout who still takes people fishing at nearly 70.
It's interesting what you say, though, about the fishing. I was just thinking about it when you were saying that fishing being a constant in your life. And it is to some of us, isn't it? And I think I may have said this before, and apologies if I have, that, you know, to us, our lives are shaped by it and revolves around it. And to others, it's a pastime that they do and enjoy, which is fantastic. And then you also get people who dip in and out of it, and they may burn bright with it for a short time and then go away, go do something else, and then they may come back, they may not. They just like that mastering of something new. But to some of us, it bites so deeply that it's really difficult to shake it, isn't it? And you're often thinking about it or doing something associated with it. And it's something it's clearly been the case for yourself as well, hasn't it?
Yeah. Well, I mean, if there's such a thing as fate, it certainly helped me, because when I lived in Australia, I went to Australia about a year after college, travelled down through sort of Southeast Asia, found, what's it called, Five Spot Arcade in Hong Kong, I think, on the way down, and found affordable fishing tackle for probably the first time in my life, you know. Especially fly fishing stuff at that time, because it used to be a bit of a premium, didn't it? And sort of bought stuff. And when I was in Australia, when we kind of, I went over there to try and take up a teaching job at an art school. But then we found that on the way back down, obviously because the pill doesn't work when you've got the trots, I was about to have a family. And in true responsible style, as soon as we found out, we thought, shit, this is our last chance. So we bought an old Holden and took off into the bush. And the bush included Tasmania. And when I hit Tassie, I mean, it's a... I tell you what, if it wasn't for the bloody tiger snakes, Tasmania would be New Zealand.
I'm with you.
You do see a lot of snakes. You do see a lot of snakes when you're fishing in Tassie. As you probably
yeah, I've been lucky enough to fish in New Zealand, and the joy of it was that there was no snakes there. And I'm petrified. Everything else I love, but snakes, I'm petrified. It's the same when I'm out in the Midwest. I'm forever just listening for rattlers. And I'm petrified I'm going to see a bloody rattler somewhere along the way. So I can see what you mean about Tasmania. Because although that's, I remember Nick Raygart from Gin Clear did a really cool film about Tasmania and the lakes there. But they've also got amazing streams with trout in as well. There's a real mix of fishing there.
Oh, God, yeah. I mean, yeah, they've got, when you get up into, like the northwest of the island, where everybody's got names, everywhere's got names that make you think you're in Devon. You've got Breakaday Creek and the Meander and things like that up there, which are just, yeah, they're like a chalk stream, really. And then you've got the rivers up in the Western Tiers, which are more like kind of freestone rivers that flow into huge. It's a very similar, actually. I was thinking about it last time I was in New Zealand. It's very similar kind of setup, in so much as you've got big lake trout that run up into the rivers. It's almost like fishing for sea trout, fishing for big browns out there, I think. I don't know if your experience is the same.
No, I didn't get to do that. Yeah, that may immediately makes me think of the Tongariro and the fish moving up through there, which are only fish South Island. So I didn't, but yeah, that makes perfect sense, doesn't it? And like the South American story as well, that sort of thing. So
yeah, when you go into the South, I mean, most of the, yeah, obviously you've got the West Coast rivers that flow into the sea, but Otago and southern, God, what's the name?
Would it be Invercargill?
Well, up above Christchurch. Yeah, you know, the most of the rivers there are feed into lakes. I mean, the up around Twizel, most of those rivers flow down into that kind of Benmore system. And last time I was out there with a load of Norwegian delinquents, actually, which was quite interesting. But Gear, my old mate from salmon guiding in Norway, he reckons that the big old trout, when they come up to spawn in the rivers, the big old boys stake out those deeper kind of holding places in the river and just stay there waiting for the girls to come to them. But, yeah, you know, I mean, we all love tacking a theory onto everything, don't we, as they say?
Yeah, you got to, haven't you? It's usually wrong when I do it, but it's fun anyway.
Doesn't matter. I mean, I always say to people, you've got to have a plan. Even if it's not a particularly good plan, it's better than no plan at all.
Yeah, it's usually for me, plan B works best, but there we go anyway. But so you also did some saltwater fishing down there. So it's the 1970s. And, you know, for me, this is really interesting because nowadays it is really easy to get information and work out where to go or get in touch with somebody who knows what's happening. Whereas then, I guess, it wasn't so easy to do so, and so you're figuring it out as you go along. Is that how it worked? Particularly the saltwater thing for me that you were doing down there was really interesting. And did you just sort of figure it out as you went along? How did that work for you?
Well, really, I mean, you know, I can't spin, Pete. I don't know what it is about me. I mean, I, you know, to deviate slightly. A really good old guy I met because I guided him for salmon once, and we used to call him Metal Mickey. He was immortalised as Metal Mickey by Charles Rangeley Wilson in an article on last minute salmon fishing that he asked me to organise for him. And we went up to my mate George's bit of the Annan, and Mickey caught 13 salmon one day on flying seas. And I always said to Mickey, right, you teach me how to spin, I'll teach you how to fly fish, Mickey. Well, it worked for him, but it didn't work for me, because he'd give me a rod, he'd tell me where to cast, I'd cast the bloody thing out, I'd have about half a dozen goes and get fed up, and the rod, he'd catch a fish straight away. I mean, it's something I've never had you could count the salmon I've caught on a fly, on a spinner on one hand, really, because I just don't, the engagement goes for me far too quickly. I'm not saying that, you know, I understand that spinning's a skill, a great skill. I used to fish with a guy called Andrew Murray. I had the tackle shop in Carlisle, not the Andrew Murray, the Hardy man, but another Andrew Murray. And Andrew had one of those piano boxes with massive ranges of different weights of spinner and Devon and things like that. I would just tie on a Zebra Toby, chuck out a few times. If one didn't grab it, I'd go home. You know, it didn't float my boat, unfortunately.
Yeah, I was similar. Funny enough, that, you know, you had to, for the level two, I don't know if it's the same now, I had to do spinning. And I remember practicing for the instructor's thing with Nick. And the thing, I nearly broke my toes where the weight hit my, it was so bad. And he's laughing at me. And I said, what are you laughing at? He said, well, I'm used to seeing you cast a fly rod and you kind of know what you're doing. And and it was terrible. And it's going about 6-7 feet in front of me. And then when I did the AAP guy, it was in there. And it was the only thing, they took it out at the last minute. It was the only thing I was worried about the exam, not being, you know, dingy, but it was the thing I was most worried about was the spinning thing. And they took it out, and I couldn't believe the sense of relief I experienced when I realized I didn't have to do a spinning demonstration with a multiplier and everything else. So I was really, really pleased with that. So that's how that happened for you down in Australia then. So you didn't spin, so you had your fly rod with you, and it was a case of go find some fly rod.
I mean, you know, like, how do you talk about sea fishing? It's really difficult. It's the biggest lake in the world, isn't it? And I was never very... I never really did the reservoir thing very much. I did a bit, but not very much. I used to, my local angling club used to go to Grafham, and it's a great big, it's a massive big sameness. So how I picked up on the fly fishing out there in the sea was initially fishing estuaries, mainly for sea trout, actually. And fishing for sea trout, started catching cowhide. Australians, they call them cowhide in New Zealand, Australian salmon in Australia, because they're a bit spotty, and you know what, everything's onomatopoeic in Australia, you know, black snake, brown snake, salmon's got spots. Anyway, but there's always feature no matter where you are. And you know, on those surf beaches you get those gullies. Now, the other thing I was very keen on when I was a younger, fitter lad was surfing. I picked up surfing from a bunch of mad Australians in Bali, actually, on my way to Australia originally. Mick and Steve took me under their wing. And when I got to Australia, one of the things I did was make myself a surfboard. So I understood what was going on surf beaches and just applied that to the fishing, if you see what I mean. And really, it was kind of, in the early days, it was trying to find somewhere to fish down and across. So I was looking for rips, you know, that I knew how to identify from the surfing thing, and just casting across the rips and letting the fly really trundle like you would, you know, like when you're down and across fishing for sea trout, you know, you kind of, and then you try and impose your will on it, don't you? You make the fly come into life in the right place. You know, and it's like, you know, you cast out thinking, right, I'm not going to be fishing until it's there, and I want it set up in exactly the right way to fish in there. And the fish were kind to me, Pete, you know. And initially they're kind, and then you kind of get better at what you're doing, don't you? And yeah, I mean, that's it really in a nutshell. I mean, that was saltwater fly fishing to start off with. On the mouth of the Arthur River and Aries Inlet in Victoria, on the Arthur River in Tassie, where they had a fantastic run of sea trout. I mean, I'm surprised that the sea trout fishing in both Australia and Tasmania hasn't really kind of clicked as I would have expected it to do, you know. I mean, you don't really hear many people going out there to fish for sea trout, do you?
No, I had no idea until you mentioned that, I have to say.
Well, all those, you know, they all came from that. Boat that went to Plenty. There's a salmon hatchery in Plenty, in just north of Hobart, and they all went out by boat, packed in sphagnum moss in boxes, to this hatchery where they started producing salmon and trout in the late 1800s, I think. And all those southern hemisphere trout all come from there. You know, they were taken to New Zealand, they were taken to South Africa, they were taken to Argentina from this place in Tasmania, anecdotally. I mean, I wouldn't swear to that on anything, really. I wouldn't swear to that on presentation by Jason Borger. There you go. Gary Borger, sorry, his dad.
But that's really interesting you mentioned that, because you're dead right about the trout, from what I've read as well. And the trout were almost just a last minute addition to the journey, because it was salmon they wanted to get down there, wasn't it? And then somebody said, oh, if you've got room, can I put these trout in? And of course, the salmon, from what I gather, went into the river, but they never really came back, did they? And so it's where that's where the trout actually got that foothold, and then everything else that went with it.
Well, absolutely. I mean, you get Pacific salmon, quinnet and things like that down in both Tasmania and South Island. Well, I don't know about North Island. I never saw any salmon fishermen in North Island, but I'm sure they're there as well. But the sea trout just populated all those South Island rivers. I think they stuck a load of rainbows into Rotorua and Taupo, didn't they? But I think most of the brown trout working their way around the rivers is all down to their sea trout habit. You know, it's not, they didn't stock all those rivers individually. They all found their way into them via the sea, you know.
Yeah, that's an interesting point as well, isn't it? Because the rivers, our rivers even, were naturally populated. When they were first populated, it was sea trout that came in that populated them, wasn't it? And that's how it first happened. It's a funny way to think of it, really, isn't it? But it's how it must have happened.
Well, absolutely. After the last ice age, absolutely right. Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I do.
No, I was going to say, please crack on.
No. I mean, it's something that Richard Slocock and I often talk about down here. How many of the sea trout that are running the chalk streams of England are stockies that fell back to sea looking for something to eat, you know, because it's in their genetic makeup to do it. And I'm sure a hell of a lot of the sea trout that they catch down at Testwood Pool and places like that are assisted, shall we say, by the stocking of the rivers, you know, because you know what it's like. I mean, well, the way I understand it is that a brown trout is not a particularly social being, and they're looking for somewhere where they can find enough food to maintain the biological imperative, if you see what I mean. So they just drop back, and eventually they find the sea. The sea feeding's incredibly rich, but they can't lay their eggs in the sea because they'd float. So they have to go back to the river. And, it interests me to find... I'd be interested to see what happened if we didn't stock any of the rivers for a few years. But in a way, it's... I don't know if you remember Maitland, do you? Professor somebody Maitland?
Don't know.
Well, he did a series of... when I was up in Scotland and we were all blowing up impassable barriers and things like that, Maitland did a kind of tour of the country, lecturing on the danger of that for any genetic integrity that we might still have in trout populations in this country. So he said the only place that the Howeytown phenomenon, you know, the Loch Leven strain trout weren't. He was a geneticist, biologist, fisheries biologist. And he reckoned that business that they set up at Howeytown to introduce Loch Leven strain trout, he reckoned for the first 3 years they just gave away their production to angling clubs all over the country to establish the business, as it were, so that strain is in trout throughout the British Isles, really. And the only kind of genetic purity, I mean, I'm not a eugenicist, don't get me wrong, but the pure genetic code for brown trout only existed in those places that were inaccessible for various reasons above impassable dams. And we, you know, it was just his cautionary note. And I love people that put up cautionary notes because it's you don't have to act on them, but it's nice to know about them.
Yeah, absolutely. So the trip to Australia wound up, and then you moved back and you came to Scotland, Hebrides.
Well, initially, I was still going to be a painter then, Pete, for fuck's sake.
Right.
Sorry. And I got a... there was an artist housing association called ACME in London at the time, and I got a house off them to use to do up as a studio. But it was in Beck Road, which is, one of the great... I might have been good at fishing, but financial decisions have always been a complete arsehole for me, because I was offered this house, and it was in Beck Road, and it looked like Coronation Street. And my boy was about 18, about 2 years old then. But he'd hardly ever worn clothes before that, living out in Australia in the heat. And suddenly I'm offered a place in Beck Road where the actual overground tube line passes across the street three doors down and things like that. And I just thought, Christ, I just can't do this. And There used to be a weekly paper at that time called Dalton's Weekly. I don't know if you remember it. But anyway, in Dalton's Weekly, there was a farmer in South Wales, in near Verwig, down near Cardigan, who was looking for somebody to help him clear fields during the winter, ploughing, taking the stones back out to the walls. And accommodation came with it. So I upshipped and went down there and worked as a farm labourer and started fishing in Wales. While I was in Wales, we had to get out of that place at the end because his wife used it as a summer let. So we moved up to a place called Gogginham, which is up above Aberystwyth. And then from inquiries at Aberystwyth, I got an interview for a job as a forestry technician on the back of a pile of bullshit and a job I'd done for Netak Timber out in Tasmania. I suddenly found myself as working for the forestry department and the wood science department at Bangor University and living on Anglesey. I lived near Aberfraw in Anglesey, and there you had a lake that Sea Trout used to run up to and spend time in the lake and then run back out to sea down across the meadows. So then again, started catching fish on the fly in the sea there from fishing the estuary for sea trout once again. Not that there is an estuary there really, but and while I was there, my wife was setting up a knitwear business. She was hand spinning and knitting jumpers at that time, and we were taking them to London to sell in Christmas sales and that kind of thing. And one of the people that came on the stand was an American lady who said, "Oh, do you sell these in America?" And we said, "No, should we?" kind of thing. And anyway, from that, by a very devious route, we started making cashmere jumpers. And then when I was still at Bangor, we found a place in Scotland and moved up to Scotland, because Scotland was where you made cashmere in knitwear, in the Borders. And again, the luck thing comes in. We applied to the Scottish Development Board, and they were giving out old school properties and various things for local industry, and we applied for one as a knitwear concern, as it were, and we were offered an old roadman's cottage in Scotland. They used to have a system where they had roadmen, and they'd have a roadman lived every 10 miles, and he'd do 5 miles either side of his house, just filling in potholes and things like that. So we moved into this place, and when I walked down the bottom of the garden, there was the Border Esk.
Nice. So where would that be? I fished at Cannonby. Would you be around that neck of the woods?
I used to fish a lot around at Cannonby myself, obviously. Probably 15 miles above Cannonby. It's the other side of eight miles the other side of Langham. If you know Langham.
Not really, no. I've only fished round there. I literally came under the cover of darkness, fished there, and then came home again. So I don't know it well, but I enjoyed it, I have to say. And lovely river too. Really, really fun to fish.
Where did you fish on at Cannonby? Do you remember?
I think it was the club. We stayed at the pub there. And then fished
Cross
around
Keys
that
or the riverside.
Area. Cross Keys.
Cross Keys or the riverside?
Cross Keys.
Oh, Betty. She would have been the landlady then, I think.
Yeah. So you're sort of fishing around there. And there's been a lovely, And there's been a lovely, like you say, by luck, but there's been a lovely connection with where you've ended up and the fishing. And, you know, again, it sounds fascinating to me where you were catching sea trout in the estuary where there wouldn't have been much of a scene, I would guess, of that sort of thing. And again, it sort of is really interesting to hear about somebody going out and just doing it and having the good fortune to have the Borderesque or the Vernouille or wherever that may be really close. And it's almost, you say it's lucky, but I'm sure it's not subconscious, but it's been, your life has been intertwined by water the whole time, hasn't it?
Absolutely. My constant fascination. I mean, where I, Nethernot, where I lived at Benpath, there was a field next to the house and an escarpment that went straight down to the river. You know, not a particularly embankment rather than an escarpment. And I used to sit up on there of an evening with the dogs watching the sea trout run up the river. And fishing's one thing, but watching the water is what really teaches you everything. Because, you know, you'd think the tree trout were tied together by a bit of string. You know, sometimes a 20-minute long piece of string between one coming up at another. But they'd all take exactly the same route. There was a big stone down the bottom of this escarpment, and the river set off across the river, and every sea trout would stop for a minute there and then take off across to the other side of the river. And so you got a mental picture then, and you think, right, where's one of them? Here, where I'm fishing. And that's the thing. I mean, I work at the moment on the chalk streams, and I could go fishing whenever I like on the chalk streams, but I probably don't do as much as I did then, because it's not so much it's stupid to talk about fishing as an intellectual exercise, but that's the part of it that really fascinates me, if you see what I mean. And I think that's why I still guide people, because I like taking people out. Because I remember when I first started guiding, an old pal of mine, John Todd from Northern Ireland, he said, right, when you're guiding, Tone, what you got to do is think about fishing with bad tackle. And I said, what do you mean by that? And he said, well, you find out what you can do with it, and then you do that to the best of your ability. So basically, when I'm out with a fisherman now, I'm applying my river craft, if you like, to his abilities, rather than, like, I'm not saying a lot of guides, but quite a few guides are very good at showing people fish they could catch without any differentiation to whether that guy is actually capable of catching those fish. And you know, I do a bit of casting instruction as well, but guiding's my passion, and I'd rather work with the hand I'm dealt rather than try and, you know, I'll try and improve the hand, but I won't go into a casting lesson with people I'm guiding, because it's not the game for me.
No, I agree with you. And it is, I know what you say about the intellectual thing as well. And it's the, in effect, the person is the rod for you, aren't they? And you're sort of getting them into that position, like you say, working out their strengths and sometimes their weaknesses as well, to put them in the best position to be able to cover a fish. And then to me, I don't know if it's the same, that if I've got them there, they've made the cast, the fish has risen. Whether they hook it or not, to me, never bothered me, because I'd put them in that spot to be able to do that. So the rest is down to them. And you know, having a fish come eat the fly, like I say, whether it sticks or not, never really bothered me in the slightest.
No, I'm always on the side of the fish, Pete. No, I mean, it's, yeah. It's good talking to you, mate, because it just brings things back to mind. But you know, where I worked at Ravenswood on the Tweed as a second boatman, I call it a ghillie because that's frowned upon on the Tweed. We had a higher path that was about rod tip height above the river. Complete, you know, no silhouette. So as long as you move quietly, you could move along the top path with the rod down the bottom. Now, the amount of times I saw a fish take a fly and look back at the fisherman and they hadn't even noticed, or suddenly the rod's bent. What I discovered very quickly was never to tell a fisherman a fish had taken the fly. Because if you told them, they never hooked it. It's really weird. There seems to be like a map. I think the delay between a fish taking a salmon fly and you registering it on a 15-foot rod is sometimes so much longer than you think. But if you move it at all, they spit it out. Or they don't. It doesn't seem to hook them. And it's those things. Those are the things about fishing that will mean that it's kind of logged in here for forever. You know, the things that you think, Christ, how does that work? You know, and it's another old friend of mine that I know from art school days, who doesn't fish, who I've talked about fishing to so many, many times, thinks of what we do as a battle of wits between thee and me or a moron. Because, you know, I've explained. Now, why does the moron win so often?
So you've been fishing on the Tweed. You've been gillying there as well. You'd travelled a lot. You'd been to California, Montana, Colorado, and you'd done a hell of a lot. Did you know, I guess being a gillie as well, that you were in the fishing industry, but then you sort of went down the qualification route in the early 90s? And did you realise that was the path then, although it was probably already there and partly there in the background as well, but did you realise that was the route that you were going to go and then your life was going to be revolved and more intertwined with fishing than it previously was? Was there a moment where you knew there was a tipping point where you realised, yep, I'm going to be a guide, I'm going to be an instructor, that sort of route? When did that sort of, and how did that come about?
Well, in 1993, during one of our many financial crises, the knitwear business, which had got me the fishing in America and things like that that I'd done, basically two art students running a business was very good in a boom time, but when things got difficult. I think the Scottish vernacular is brilliant for it. We went up like a rocket and came down like the stick. And my wife was a very talented designer, and we went into voluntary liquidation. She went to work for a major knitwear company as a designer. At the meeting with the company that kind of bought our company, I said, would it sweeten this deal if I wasn't involved in it? They said yes. Were fairly generous with some gardening leave. And we had two kids, school-age kids, up in Scotland at the time. One of the things that my ex-wife would have said about me, it was probably the business would have done better if I wasn't fishing all the time. And I was in Scotland. I was about 40 then. I thought I was too old to go back to working in the woods. I'd worked in the woods for a while before, you know, with a chainsaw. I thought I was too old for that. I had a mate up the road that was the local wildlife manager. And I kind of set myself up as I had two flat coats and a Weimaraner I used for pointing at the time, and I set myself up as a kind of catch hand, sporty type person, and I'd take people. I'd go and pick up with the dogs at pheasant shoots. I'd take people pointing for grouse. I'd take people stalking roe deer, and fishing. And it was the fishing one that really, you know, because the sea trout fishing in the early 90s was booming. And I started a thing called Eskimo Borders Guide Service, which was me as a guide. And the other things fell by the way, and the fishing was the thing that really took off, Pete. And, you know, I won't make any bones about it. I used to make quite a lot of money out of it, you know, because it was at a time before Tweed Line and Fish Pal and things like that. So my little book with Gilly's phone numbers in it was invaluable. And what I offered was, you know, come up and fish like a local. You know, I'm not going to, you know, you're not going to come up to a beat that, you don't know if there's any fish in it or not. Come up and fish with me and you'll go fishing where I'd go. So I just used to, you know, ring around, find out where the fish were. I mean, it was perfectly paced. I've got the Border Esk in the back garden, the Annan 10 minutes drive one way, the Nith maybe a half an hour's drive, the Tweed. Yeah, so I've got East and West Coast rivers all around me. And you know, I could set up a good package, and a lot of people caught their first salmon with me. And you know what that's like? That's like, that's bankable, isn't it? And yeah. You know, I won't say it because I was particularly good. It was just that I've always liked people. I get on well with people. I mean, I don't care if I'm not around them, but it's I find it quite easy to chat when I'm out. So guiding sort of fell into place for me. And the first time I ever guided was in a tackle shop in Tasmania when I'd just come down from the Central Highlands, and there was a bunch of guys in the shop who wanted to go. And the guy in the tackle shop who got to know me asked me if I'd show them where to go. That was the first time I ever did guiding. That was in 87, sort of mid to late 70s. Obviously, when I'd been over in the States on business, I'd got fed up with looking at maps and finding a place where the road was near to the river and finding that every American in the world fished that particular bit. And I'd started going and going outfitters, and I'd taken a couple of guides, and I kind of, yeah, I thought, yeah, this could be all right. So I set up Eskom Borders Guide Service, and about 2 or 3 years into it, somebody said, well, you teach people to cast, you should be qualified. I think it was somebody from that guy who was up to fish, actually. So I went and did the SANA, Scottish National Anglers Association, or whatever it was at the time, instructor's course, which I passed. How I did, I don't know. And then, what was that, 74 or 75, sorry, 94 or 95. I can't actually remember, but the whole kind of move to consolidate angling instruction certification or whatever came up with the Salmon and Trout Association. And APGAI were obviously involved. Well, they didn't approve the Scottish qualification for inclusion into that. And so James Woodcock, I think it was, from the Salmon and Trout Association got in touch with me and said, would you like to do this new thing that we've got called STANIC? So I went down to Graff and Water and slept in a gritty bed in the sailing lodge and met the world of casting instruction. And it was mixed. I wouldn't say I kind of... I wouldn't say I took to it like a fish to water, Pete. But strangely enough, by that time, I teamed up with a guy called Ian Hockley, who was a brilliant, brilliant trout fisherman. Best sight nympher I've ever seen to this day. And I've obviously seen quite a few. I mean, probably on a par with kite in those movies, Ian. He was just... It was all fish body movement. It was nothing to do with feeling anything or anything. He was just, and he was right on top of the game. Anyway, I met up with him and John Todd, who I mentioned earlier, and we were on this course. Well, strangely enough, Ian passed salmon, being an occasional salmon fisherman, and I passed trout, being an occasional trout fisherman. So I just thought, oh, bunch of twats, you know. Yeah. But anyway, I did keep with it. And got my Stanick salmon, and then I got my app guy and various things, and met a load of guys. But I must admit, at the start of it, Pete, I did think, well, this is a load of guys with more money than sense who are trying to teach people who do go fishing how to do it. I wasn't initially very sold. But having said that, a lot of my dearest and best friends are in that world, and they're all lovely people and all the rest of it. But basically, I've always been a needs must guy, and a lot of the stuff that they were wanting you to do was stuff that I would just never do. You know, it wasn't stuff that I would, especially a beginner coming to the river. It's just, why fill their head with all that shit? I mean, get them on to fish first and then let it develop in a bit more of a, as a whole, shall we say. So that was when I got involved with Refis, because they were, I don't know if you remember Refis.
Yeah.
But they were, they'd embraced the guiding thing quite early on. And basically what you had to do for Refis was you had to have, you had to have something to say that you were allowed to guide on this particular water. If it was your club water, you had to have a thing from the club saying that you were an official guide on it. And you would then apply to join Refis. And then, Charlie Bingham and Richard Slocock came up to me. And I had to take them out fishing for a couple of days so they could see that I could do it. And unfortunately, when the... During the invention of Gaia, Refis sort of slipped out of the frame, but I thought they were a good organization. People used to think they were too toffee-nosed and they only had people that had their own fishing and things like that. But it wasn't really the case, I don't think. It was just that basically they had a different approach to the idea of teaching people to fish and taking people fishing that wasn't, I'm not taking anything away from fly casting, believe me. I mean, I do the BFCC stuff. I do all of it, Pete. But it's a very achievable goal, being able to cast a fly rod, compared with being able to catch a fish, isn't it? I don't know if you'd agree with that.
Yeah, you said some, really interesting things that resonated with me. We can wind back quite a long way into that conversation where you said you can get on with people, and we had guides who worked with us. That was one of the first things I looked for: their ability to be able to get on with people. You can be the greatest fly angler there is, but if you can't explain to people in simple, straightforward manner, this is what I want you to do, then I think you will struggle, and just because you're the greatest angler doesn't necessarily mean you're going to be the greatest guide. And there is a big difference between them. So to me, yes, I look for that ability. I look for that ability for people to understand what their guest for the day wants from that day. That's really important to me as well. But yes, you know, we'd teach them to cast and we'd sell a day, and it may be a beginner, and we'd teach them how to cast an upstream fly. That was important. But as a guide's point of view, is being able to backing themselves to be able to put people onto fish. And again, coming on to what you said about Rufus, and I was fully aware of that and had looked at that. And I may have now in hindsight either spoke to yourself or somebody else about it when we had somebody that I wanted to try and put through that. And that's kind of almost come full circle, hasn't it? Because we're seeing now more of a guiding culture coming into the UK in recent years, which I welcome, because, you know, people are time poor and sometimes they need some help to get them onto the river. And it was almost, to me, almost ahead of its time. And now probably the prime for it would it feels to me anyway right now.
Yeah. It's one of my disappointments with the world of angling instruction. Is that they, all the time when I was involved, because of my involvement for Rufus, because of what I do have done for a living for bloody hell since 94, Christ, a long time now. they've always been on at me to start a guide thing for Gaia or whoever. And I've always said, you can't do it because they got to know the river. You know, that's what you're, that's the most important thing for a guide. You can't have it as a kind of lesser than a casting instructor qualification, which is always where they wanted to aim it. It's got to be, you know, like being a guide is being everything. You know, if as you say, to achieve their ambitions, if what they haven't got is the ability to cast there, then obviously you've got to work on that, you know. And but there are I don't know. It's a bad one to get me on because I'm still very divided about it myself, you know, because, you know, I'm absolutely, you know, being able to cast will never stop you being able to catch fish, you know, as the famous lady whose name escapes me because I'm an old man now. What's her name? The American.
Oh, Joan Wolfe.
The Queen of Fly. Joan Wolfe, yeah, you know, yeah. I mean, you know, but I don't, well, the exception, oh, this will possibly make you chuggle. One of the guys I used to fish with up in Scotland was a bloke called Arthur Bell, who had Bell's Mill in Langham. Yeah, Richard's out. But he always fished on the association water, lovely old bloke, probably never cast more than about 50 or 60 feet in his life, right? So when he sells the mill and he retires, he goes off on an Arthur Oglesby course to Norway. And we all thought, oh, God, Arthur's going to come unstuck there. Came back, highest catcher of the week. And we said, oh, what did Arthur teach you to cast? And he said, no, I fish how I always do. but basically, Arthur fished a fly well the whole time it was in the water. To use another one of my off-repeated lines. There's no point in being up here holding a rod. You've got to be down there with the fly. And he was that, you know. And I was going to say, I don't know many very successful fishermen that aren't good casters, but Arthur, unfortunately, is the horrible exception that makes that rule, you know, if you see what I mean. And there are people that are, you know, with what I do now, with mainly the chalk stream stuff. I mean, I don't, I have no ambition to catch the last salmon, if you see what I mean. So I don't do it much anymore. With the chalk stream stuff, it's purely, if you can get a fly to them that looks enough like food before they've seen you, your chances are in the high 90s percentage wise. if they do see you, if they do see the cast land, if they do see, you know, it's a sliding scale. But on the perfect scale, a good fisherman who understands fish is always going to be, yeah, you know, they might choose to be a famous fisherman. Some of them are famous at other things. I'm sure you've met them the same as I have. I mean, there are some people out there that just gel to it. I mean, my old man had this theory that we, sort of Levi Strauss type thing, you know, that we'd grown up to live in communities of about 500 people. And in that community, a couple of people would be good at fishing, a couple of people would be good at this, a couple of people would be good at that. And they all stuck to their speciality because it's what they were good at. And I do kind of lean to the idea that fishermen have to be born, if you see what I mean.
Yeah, yeah, get you 100%. Yeah, really interesting. So you're in, as you alluded to, you're in Chalkstream Country in Dorset now. You've been down there, as far as I can recall, many, many years now, or quite a few years now. And it's sort of, I guess, it's almost full circle, I guess. And you're loving being down there as much as you always have you?
Yeah. I mean, Dorset's my, it's where my family come from, Dorset. My old man's family all came from Worth Matravers, which is a tiny little village, which was a quarry and farming fishing village where, well, everybody, I mean, I remember they bought out a book for the local pub with pictures of old, all the old people from the village. And I remember getting it and looking at it with my dad and saying, Christ, I'm related to half these people. And him saying, yeah, it's a wonder you haven't got one eye, boy. But, you know, I mean, I've always, when I came back from Australia, I wanted to live in Dorset, Pete, but I couldn't afford it. You know, I mean, I'm down here now because, well, I live with the lovely Claire, my partner, and I'd known her since probably about 18, I think. And when I finally decided that the time had come to leave Scotland, mainly because I was single then and I knew enough old guys that smelt slightly a spaniel that was single in Scotland, I didn't really want to join the ranks. So I kind of I mean, Dorset's just so familiar everywhere I know. I mean, I know I know the rivers, I know the sea around here so well. I'm like an old elephant's come back to the elephant's graveyard, I think.
But you say that, but it sounds to me, and this is probably a question I know the answer to already, and you've alluded to that, that the guiding aspect of it you're still doing, and I guess you're just enjoying that as much as you always have.
Yeah, I do. I love seeing that look that people get when they hook a fish. It's just magic, you know. It's a lovely thing, and I get to be outdoors, out by the water. I mean, everybody always thinks I take loads of foreign holidays, but I do. But yeah, I mean, I've got the most. If I, as a schoolboy, was asked to write an essay on what was the life I'd like to have, I've got it, basically. Which is quite nice, isn't it?
Yeah, nice.
Doesn't stop me being nervous and smoking too much. But
yeah. That's really cool. And I think that's, you know, we've spoken well over, we're coming up for an hour and a half now of chatting, and I feel like I've only scratched the surface of things, but it's been absolutely wonderful to catch up with you. If people want to come out with you for a day's fishing, how do they get hold of you, Tony?
Well, either through my website, or if they want to fish the famous rivers through Fishing Break, Simon Cooper. And, you know, if you want a guide, just ask for me. But all the guides are pretty good. And for me, either through Richard Slowcock, who is www.goflyfishing.uk, and there's a link directly onto my website from there. I'm tkfishing.com, and I can take you out in the chalk streams, I can take you out in the sea, whatever you like, really. If you're really desperate.
I doubt that. It's been awesome to catch up with you. It's been lovely to chat with you. And thank you so much for taking the time to talk with me. I've really enjoyed it, Tony. Thank you so much.
Perhaps we'll do the bonefish another day.
I reckon so. I wanted to learn about that as well, but we just covered so much interesting ground. And yeah, I think there's another chance for that at another time.
I'm a bit too gabby for this, and that's probably why I'm good at guiding. People don't get a chance to think about fishing because I'm mouthing off all the time. Okay.
Tony, thanks so much for being a guest. I've really enjoyed it.
Thanks, Pete.
Everyone, this has been the Fly Culture Podcast. I hope you've enjoyed this one as much as me. Thanks, everyone, for sending the messages of telling me they're enjoying it and suggestions of guests as well. I really appreciate that as well. This has been the Fly Culture Podcast, and many thanks for listening.
The Fly Culture Podcast is brought to you in association with Fly Culture, a quarterly print magazine. For more information, please visit flyculturemag.com. You can also find Fly Culture on Instagram, Facebook, and Twitter.